Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My engineer tonight is Bob Gardner, and I appreciate his work. And you can visit my website at thinkwingradio.com, also thinkwing.org. And, of course, you can always help to support KPFT at ThinkWing. I'm sorry. See, I got ThinkWing on the brain. You can always help to support KPFT at kpft.org. And click on the tip jar and just scroll down so that you can tell them ThinkWing Radio sent you. And you can help support community radio. Okay. I keep wondering if I'm on the right headset here. I don't think I'm getting volume. Hold on, I'm going to switch headsets. Okay. Actually, you don't have to hold on because, you know, switching headsets is, oh boy, that's a worse headset. Bob, am I having problem getting volume into my headsets?
Well, there's two switches. Check the one extreme left first.
Okay.
That's the main for the other four.
I like that better. Thank you, Bob. Okay, so starting off with smaller stuff and working up to bigger stuff. First, I will say open forum. So if you have something on your mind you want to talk about, it doesn't have to be a topic I raise. Oh, I spend a lot of time raising topics, but it doesn't have to be a topic I raise. You can call 713-526-5738. As always, I would like to recommend to people that you make sure you're registered to vote. If you are not registered, you can go to harrisvotes.com or you can go to votetexas.gov. Either way, you can get the information that you need to register to vote or to find out if you're registered for that matter. Another thing that I thought I would raise that's kind of interesting, you know, one of the issues that I have with ebooks, I have two main issues with ebooks. I think that given the fact that they don't require typesetting, printing, storage, shipping, return shipping, physical space, I just feel like ebooks should be a whole lot cheaper. To say they're 10% or 20% less than a physical version, to me, that's inexplicable. I think based on cost and a reasonable profit, I don't see how they can sell for more than half of physical book price. So that's a thing. My other thing is, I think there's a serious question whether you own an ebook or you're just leasing it. As an example, Now, it may have changed, but I don't think you have any way of lending an ebook to anybody. It's in your database. You can't go to Half Price Books and sell your ebook to Half Price Books. So what you obviously have is an impaired sort of ownership. Well, you know, they're always looking for ways to extract money from you, and I think that there's an interesting question whether it is more economical as a consumer to buy software and then get regular updates for like bug fixes and security and stuff, and maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line get an upgraded package of the software, or is it better as a consumer to pay a monthly or annual fee for the use of the software from the cloud? Now, as an example, Microsoft, for their Office 365 personal version, they want $70 a year. Now, when you think about it, $70 a year isn't necessarily a bad deal. If you are buying a non-student version, full version of Office, I think that they tend to run like anywhere from $300 to $600, depending on how many modules you have. So if you have Office 365, if you're actually buying the software, I mean, that's the stipulation here. If you're actually buying the software, so 3 years of Microsoft 365 Office, say $210, but you're constantly getting the best features, the best upgrades, not just bug fixes and security fixes. That can make sense. On the other hand, if you go to like Adobe, if you want the entire collection of 20-plus creative desktop and mobile apps, including Photoshop CC and Illustrator CC is how they designate it, that's $49.99 a month. So now you're talking about not owning the Adobe package and still paying about $600 a year for the Adobe package. So this gets into how many things can you have in your life? It's kind of like you go to the rent-a-center and you don't own anything, and everything you use and everything you have, you're just paying a monthly fee for. So you're paying now a monthly fee for cable TV, internet, telephone. I mean, that's something we've been doing for a long time. It doesn't feel so weird. But then you're paying a monthly fee or an annual fee for the software you use on your computer with different potential values there, the music you listen to. It kind of goes on and on and on. So you could end up with these monthly service bills running $300-$500, and you haven't even gotten to things like your electric, your gas, your rent, your food. I don't know. This is a circumstance that I am constantly thinking about and wondering where the break point is for the cost of basically living, conducting your life in a modern fashion, once you don't own anything and everything is broken down into a monthly fee. Tough. Open forum, 713-526-5738. I have Jerry on the line. I've been letting him sit for a few minutes. I apologize for that, but there are at least a couple of things I wanted to get out. So, Jerry, you're on the air. How you doing?
All right. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. What's up?
Well, I just thought I would talk a little bit. I said I was going to talk, or we needed to talk someday about some of our defense issues that we're looking at here, security issues that we're looking at here going forward.
Yep.
And all that. And I think it's important to talk about that. Actually, there's a number of issues there, but I thought I would start out with the big one, which we've talked about before, which is China.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to mention that. The thing about China is they want control over the whole South China Sea.
Yeah, and a large section of the East China Sea as well.
Yeah, most of the East China Sea too. Yeah, that's just it.
They have a very expansive notion of what constitutes Chinese territory.
Well, that's true, but the problem is over half the world's commercial shipping goes through the South China Sea.
Well, that's a part of the problem that is important to the United States and other countries, but there's also the issue of a half a dozen other countries that claim parts of the South China Sea.
Well, that's true. That's what's in the news all the time.
And
they're clashing over.
But then in addition to that, in addition to economic zones and territorial zones, and then you've got areas that if China wasn't claiming them would be high seas.
Yeah.
That would not be anybody's territory or economic zone. And China keeps using things like, well, this was a historic part of China. And you go back 2,000 years and everything belonged to somebody else.
Yeah, that's just it. And actually, there's even a thing, that supposedly the Chinese came, or like among, like, you know, there was some kind of Chinese guy that actually came to, like, the Americas back before Christ or whatever. I saw a thing like that
like,
one time.
Yeah, like the 11th
century. Where does
that
end?
Yeah, back in the 11th century, there was a Chinese emperor that actually built the largest ocean-going fleet in the world based on the designs of Chinese junks, but built to an ocean-going standard. And I believe that the history, it doesn't necessarily say it, but there are strong implications that he was a very exploration-oriented emperor, that some of his ships may in fact have made it to the west coast of the Americas, probably Southwest North America. There may, in fact, be some genetic evidence of that at some point, we may see.
Yeah.
But that the subsequent emperor, because China has always historically or almost always considered itself the center of the world, the Middle Kingdom, and this next emperor came in after the exploration-oriented emperor and said, we don't need no stinking navy. We're China. We're the middle of the world already. Everybody has to come to us. And he basically had the fleet burned. That's the legend. As I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true. There was a big fleet that went around like that, and basically they went around trading, but they also went around demanding, basically tribute. And of course, you know, when you show up with a big Navy and you seem like you know what you're doing and they don't have anything like that, then, you know, you tend to get tribute from them.
Yeah.
But, you know, they tended to give up the tribute. But, you know, I just wanted to mention that, and also the fact that there's also an economic dimension to this we need to think about. And by the way, I totally agree with you. This isn't wholly unrelated. I agree with you 100% that manufacturing, keeping manufacturing in the U.S. at least up to a point, a certain level, is a national security issue.
Absolutely.
And everything. And I've said that before myself, I think, on the air, but it was years ago. But, you know, but I think that's absolutely true. And in relation to that, you know, basically what they're talking about in China right now is a soft landing for China. I don't know that China's going to have a soft landing, and even if they do, what they consider to be a soft landing, you know, may still spell, you know, if it happens soon enough, could still spell, you know, like global recession.
Well, you raised two points that are really interesting, because in addition to the national security issue of having a manufacturing base in the United States, when you look at the issue of domestic tranquility, that people that don't have adequate paying jobs or can't find jobs, there are people that, you know, they're just not of the sort that are going to be working on computer software or data entry or working on high-tech machines with a lot of electronic circuit boards. There are just people that are not mentally and physically set for that. To some extent, it's me. And we need a manufacturing base not only as a matter of national security, but as a matter of domestic tranquility, which is also a matter of national security. I mean, it's giving us Trump.
No, it's like I've said to Barry before, you know, basically if you push things far enough, Republicans and Tea Party people, if you push stuff far enough, all you Ayn Rand fans out there, if you push stuff far enough, we'll get back to where we were in the early 30s.
Well,
and
including the unrest,
you'll be willing to pay for social and political peace.
Including the unrest we had in the 1920s and 30s, which is one of the reasons that FDR was moved to create the social programs that he created.
Yeah.
Another point that you were making about China, whether or not they might go into a soft landing because they had sort of a real estate bubble and they're having sort of a banking bubble and they have a lot of actually open capacity in their factories because of slack demand around the world. And they have another issue coming up, which I've talked about, which for whatever reason, the international media has not focused on, and they need to. They had this one-child policy for like 40 or 50 years. And,
yeah,
you know,
didn't I text you something? Didn't I send over an article about that to you?
You may have. I've really
okay.
not.
Well, there's a thing in the latest New York Review of Books or on the New York Review website about that. It's called China's Biggest Mistake with a question mark on it. It's the title.
Well, I mean, the concept made perfect sense. If they had not had the one-child policy, the population of China now would be like 2 billion. As it is, the population is 1.5 billion. And they felt that that kind of population growth would be unsustainable. So the premise made sense. But there is going to be a multi-generational period of adjustment. You know, you've got European countries, the United States, Canada, Australia, all these so-called developed countries, if not for immigration, would have declining population. And in fact, Japan, which doesn't have immigration, has a declining aging population. They're having their own demographic crisis.
Yeah,
but China is going to have an enormous demographic crisis. Now, the problem China has up till this point is getting old people to retire early enough so that young people can get jobs, which for them is their issue of domestic tranquility. Unemployed people make trouble, so you want to have jobs for them. But now you're going to get to a point where you don't have enough workers, and you have too many old people. And, you know, in 50 or 75 years, that'll sort itself out, but a lot happens between here and there. And, you know, one of the things that I've said on the air, and I don't know that it's an original idea to me necessarily, but it hasn't been widely discussed, is that a lot of this Chinese expansionism and aggressive expansion of, like, their navy and their claims on territory, arguably what they may be trying to do is prepare for the time when they will have much more internal disorder.
Yeah.
Because of this demographic crash that they're going to be working on soon.
Well, that's true. And they're also going to have a lot more men. They're going to have several million more men than they are women.
Yes.
Over an extended period. And a lot of security analysts have said that that's kind of correlated. It's sort of, there's still some controversy about it, but some security analysts have said that that's associated with, you know, more violent or more adventurous behavior, more aggressive behavior by states that have something like that. They wind up behaving in ways sometimes that, you know, aren't really good for everybody else.
Well, when you have,
necessarily for themselves.
When you have a demographic crash that leaves you with a statistically significant surplus of males, all of a sudden it changes the military calculus because you have surplus manpower.
Yeah.
And I'm not going back to the old thing about the Chinese don't value human life. I'm talking about military math, which every country uses in one way or another.
Yeah, that's true.
Let me make a quick station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I think we get out about 70 miles from downtown Houston. So even if you're in College Station, if you're on a high enough ground, you can hear us. Also, remember, at KPFT, you can go to kpft.org and contribute to the tip jar, and hopefully you'll mention that Think Wing Radio sent you and help support community radio. It's something that we do, like, every several months, but it's something that's good to mention all the time. And, of course, Bob Gardner is my engineer. So, I mean, speaking about China, we live in a really complicated world, and I think that we need much smarter leadership to navigate it.
Yeah, it's much more complicated than it used to be.
Yeah.
Let's say it wasn't complicated before, but it's basically gotten like a whole order of magnitude more complicated, and we don't have quite the power we used to have or the influence.
Well, of course, power, we're talking relative power. We have a lot of power. We spend more money on defense. We have some of the best equipment, some of the best people. I think that we need to have it dispersed more through the population. I have issues with an all-volunteer military as currently configured. But, you know, given that, we also have sort of A-list, B-list, and C-list competitors.
Yeah.
So now we have a tripolar world where we've got a weak but aggressive Russia trying to prove itself. We've got China, a rising power, which is trying to expand its influence and control and push back the United States in areas that we've been basically controlling for the last half century or so.
Yeah.
And then you've got regional powers like Iran and Israel.
Turkey.
And Turkey.
Yeah.
And in Africa, you've got Nigeria and South Africa. You know, Egypt is in disarray, but not a weak country, Israel. So there are a lot of regional players. And then you have militarization going on now in South and Central America, where you've got some leaders that seem to be aggressive on old territorial claims, some more legitimate than others. So now you've got not just police force level militaries, but you've got them buying things like fighter jets and fighter bombers. And, you know, it's the world is awash in weaponry.
That's true.
And it is creating a very dangerous place. You know, there's an old saying, I think it might have been Lenin, who said that when it comes time to hang the capitalists, they'll compete to sell us the rope. And I think that the arms dealing nations might end up resembling that.
Well, that's true. And then there's also the whole issue, I don't want to quite leak China yet, though you made a couple of points. You said something there I wanted to make a couple of points on. There's also the fact that it seems like Xi wants to be the new Mao. I've been wondering about this for some time because there was
again.
A lot of comment about, you know, there's all this anti-corruption stuff, but he seems to be using it, these anti-corruption movements or organizations or whatever, basically to consolidate his own power.
I'm sorry, who are you talking about?
Xi Jinping.
Oh, okay. The Chinese premier.
Yeah, I said Xi. I didn't.
Chinese president.
Yeah, I just said Xi, but.
I thought you said GE, like the company.
No, Xi.
Okay.
Xi Jinping and all that. And it seems like he wants to be the next Mao. So I don't know. That's something I've been wondering about. I was hoping that he would operate in a different fashion, but everything he's doing kind of indicates that he wants to go. He wants to take much more of a what they call Leninist path or Maoist path than we were expecting politically, if nothing else.
I don't know. I think more of an imperialist path. But in any case, Gary, I appreciate your call and the time you spent with me.
Oh,
I've got a couple of other folks now I want to
return. Yeah, I'll let you go. Yeah,
I appreciate it so much. And I will be looking at those links you sent me, I promise.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much, Jerry. Quick ID, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM. We do have open lines, 713-526-5738. It is open forum, so you can talk about anything you want or anything that we've been discussing. And I believe that Gary is next. Gary, you're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
Hello, I'm okay. I have two comments. Number one, you made an observation, or your previous guest did, about our leaders not being able to solve our problems, and there's two points to that. Number one, those who strive to lead are unworthy of leading.
Yeah, that's... Now, who is it that said that, do you know?
I did. I don't think it was a quote, but it seems to me that anyone that's motivated and possibly megalomaniacal enough to think that they should be the leader of the world or the country, I give you Putin, I give you, well, let's not go there, obviously are motivated by factors. You know, an interesting thing, Ted Cruz was someone, I read in a kind of a biography that he wanted to be the president of the United States since he was in the eighth grade. Okay, he didn't want to be an artist, a scientist, a doctor, a professor. He wanted to be the president of the United States. This was his only motivation. They said the same thing about Rubio. That makes you wonder if, you know, you're that single, you know, that's your sole objective. What are your motivations? Is it sort of a personal ambition, or do you really have the knowledge and the skill to actually be a leader? But that's beside the point.
Well, now, hold on. Let me respond to that for a moment. I hear what you're saying. I substantially agree. I think anybody who puts themselves up for leadership positions has to have an ego that is different from the average person who won't, whether it's self-confidence or narcissism or a God-given sense, what they feel is a God-given sense that it's up to them to help precipitate change, whatever that change may be. I mean, they're obviously different. But there's also the issue of how many kids in elementary school, in junior high school, are thinking, I want to be president of the United States. It's like, I want to be a fireman. I want to be an actor. I want to be Bill Gates. And, you know, life is a pyramid, I've often said, where at the bottom, anything is possible. You've got this wide base of potential, and the older you get, the higher you get up the pyramid, where the potentialities become narrower and narrower until you get to the top, where you're on Social Security, and mostly at that point, you're not doing too much of anything.
I think circumstances produce leaders. I don't think leaders produce circumstances. I think that, history has shown that the greatest leaders came about when they were needed. They didn't come about because they wanted to be needed. Name one.
Winston Churchill. He was in government on one level or another for, 20, 30 years before
Winston
he became...
Winston Churchill, who said, and I quote, "Those who fail to plan, plan to fail." He was a great leader, and that's because he rose to the occasion.
But he wanted to be a leader, which goes back to your point. Sometimes the great leaders rise to the top.
He didn't want to be a leader. He wanted to serve his country.
Wow.
There's a difference.
He became the leader of the Conservative Party, wasn't it? He was the leader of the Conservative Party of the Tories.
And then Hitler intervened, and he rose to the occasion, which is what made him a great leader.
And then immediately after, he was voted out of office.
But anyway,
ungrateful
I wanted to
sots.
Comment on, you made an observation that the world is very complicated.
Yes.
And it truly is. Now, we're talking about China, the most populous nation on Earth, and we're talking about India and all these others.
Yes.
We need to observe, and I'm back on my same old story here, we need to observe that the most successful countries were the least populated, and the countries that we call developing countries, okay, quote unquote, are the most populated relative to their geography, okay? So there seems to be a correlation between population and success and advancement. And I think that's why the Chinese had their one-child policy. They realized that, and it's occurring, and we have a population issue that is affecting every issue, economic and not only global warming and all of that crap, but just the very interrelationship of various nations. And nobody, it's like the barn's burning down, and we're trying to decide what color we want to paint it. Nobody is addressing the earth that we're all living on that is dying, and we'd rather address our petty little interrelational issues between Lebanon and Israel and Syria and Iraq and Turkey and Kurds and Germany and France and the Greeks and the... You see what I'm saying?
Well, I think...
Is there a real leader out there anywhere who is saying, holy moly, our house is burning down and we need to figure out how to put the fire out instead of whether we want to have the South China Sea or we want to have, you know, Argentina or we want to have... I'm babbling, but you see my point.
Here's a thing I would say, and then I'm going to let you go to talk to the next caller, if that's all right.
Please. What? I just got to make this point. We are ignoring the seriousness of our situation and dwelling. Let me give you a quote.
Hold on. I think, unless you have a really short quote, but
it's from Eleanor Roosevelt.
Okay.
Eleanor Roosevelt said, "Great minds discuss ideas. Average minds discuss events. Small minds discuss people." And, you know, this whole thing with Trump and Cruz and Hillary and Bernie, and it's like, oh, what do we got, 12 people on the planet that are of value to us?
Here's the thing that I once heard, and I may look it up sometime so I can actually cite it, but many years ago I heard that there was a study, I don't know whether it was formal or informal, from, I think it was a psychologist, and he wanted to know if people tended to elect smart leaders, average leaders, or dumb leaders. And according to this person, as I recall it, he concluded that people tend to elect leaders at the median intelligence level because that is the average intelligence level of the voter. So highly intelligent leaders don't usually get elected because people... Most people, most voters, don't understand their policies because their reasoning of the complexity of the issues and how you might address them is just beyond the average voter. Essentially, what it comes down to is people want simple solutions to complex problems.
One last question.
Yeah.
Would a highly intelligent person choose to be a leader? Hello.
I think that's a great place to leave it, because I think that's a great thought question.
Thank you. Think about it.
All right. Thanks, Gary, for calling. Take care.
Love your show.
Thank you so much. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My engineer is Bob Gartner, and you can support KPFT by going to kpft.org, clicking on the tip jar, scrolling down so you tell them Think Wing Radio sent you, and contributing what you can. It is, and I might mention, since we're in tax season, tax deductible if you itemize. We have open forum. We have open lines. Phone number is 713-526-5738 if you want to participate in the conversation, if you've got anything you want to talk about. And next up is Bill. Bill, you're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm going to throw a little chaos into the deal with China.
My. Okay, go ahead.
China had started in 2000 a project called 2030, in which they will divest half of their workforce into robotics.
Say that part again. They will do what with half of their workforce?
They're doing away with half of their workforce.
Oh, I have heard something about that.
Yeah, and well, it's true. They're doing it. They're taking just like maybe every fifth person and training them to work on the robots that'll be used in manufacturing.
Which raises the question of what about the other four people?
Well, the other four people are being displaced.
Which, from a Chinese standpoint, it leads to potential social unrest, and that's the balancing act they have to play.
Yeah, or they're going to start sending them to the U.S. to work.
I mean, it's not that easy. There are certainly a lot of...
I know there's immigration bills that put a big block into that.
Yes. Well, I mean, I have sort of entree into the academic research world, and certainly I know there are a lot of Chinese and Taiwanese expatriates. Some of them have green cards. Some of them have work visas. Some of them have acquired citizenship. There is a heavy penetration of East Asians into academia, into research and science work.
Yeah, I've encountered that.
But then the question is, if not for them, who? And the vast majority of these people become loyal to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Very loyal.
So this is not necessarily a bad thing. But when you talk about the concept of China moving blocks of people to the United States, I don't see that. I can see, now that you mention it, certainly, I can see that their robotic strategy may be a way of dealing with the demographic collapse they're going to have as the aged people retire and die, and you suddenly have this drop-off in the workforce. But you've got, here's another thing that we haven't discussed yet tonight about this demographic collapse. Jerry mentioned about the surplus that they have of males. It's a statistically significant surplus. Normally you have like 50.5% female and 49.5% male or something very close to that. Right now in China, because there is a preference, a cultural preference for males, I think right now it's like 55% males to 45% females. So finding a mate for a man tends to be increasingly challenging, and it's having all kinds of distortional effects on their culture. And now here's the kicker. So they are starting to import brides. They're importing brides from Latin America. They're importing brides from Africa. Now, in and of itself, this is, you know, internationally,
it's good for Latin America and Africa because of their economic situation.
Well, it's good, except for then it creates potentially a male surplus in those places. But here's the really interesting part. China is a predominantly homogeneous ethnic nation. It is like 90% Han Chinese.
Yeah.
You have smaller ethnicities. You've got Manchurian. You've got the West Chinese ethnic group. Some of them are Muslim. But China's like 90% Han, and they don't look favorably on mixed-race children in China. We talk about this whole Middle Earth thing, middle of the world. Japan, the same. to some extent, Vietnam, similar. And now you've got 10% of the males potentially importing non-Han brides. So now you're talking about the next demographic challenge they're going to have is, what are they going to do with all of these mixed-race children who are going to be potentially treated as second-class citizens when, again, one of the primary goals of Chinese leadership is domestic tranquility?
That's true.
All of this gets really, really interesting. You know, if you can just sit back and watch without worrying about the impacts on yourself, this stuff gets really interesting.
Yeah, because everything has to balance.
At some point, everything has a consequence.
Yeah.
Nothing's free, as they say.
No.
So there's always a consequence. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And every political decision has a consequence. And you know, the United States has made some political decisions that has hollowed out our manufacturing and has changed our citizen participation in our military defense, and has resulted in significant income inequality. And, I mean, all of these different issues, all of these are the results of political decisions that have been made over periods of time by either individuals or collective leaderships.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, they've got an older population in China, and that's one of the key factors that they look at is, you know, they try to put them on a pension, but, you know, when you have that many people retiring...
Let me tell you about pensions in China. They're tiny, and they're not indexed.
That's true.
So one of the things that China has been doing is trying to guilt and in some cases make illegal the failure of offspring to care for their parents and leaving them as burdens to the state. There is actually an effort in China to criminalize children who do not adequately support and care for their parents.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yes, and it's because, I'll give you an example. My in-laws, because my wife is Chinese, she is a citizen. Her mother now lives with us on a green card. Her father passed away several years ago. But when they were living in China, the father, who had been a truck driver all his life, ice road trucker, as it happens, he was on a pension of something like 55 yen per month, which is something at the time like $8.
Yeah.
And that's the pension that my mother-in-law still gets as a survivor. She gets the equivalent of about $8 a month, yeah, which it stays in China. It doesn't pay to move it over. But, you know, when you have elderly people on non-indexed retirements, and right now, to live in China, you really need something like 1,000 yen a month.
Yeah, easy, because prices are going up tremendously in
Absolutely.
China.
Do you know, I was in China a few years ago. I've been there two or three times, once to Taiwan, maybe twice to mainland China, northeastern China. The thing that struck me the most is, to me, you would think that the raison d'etre, the reason to exist for a supposedly communist socialist government, is that people at least minimally are taken care of. And I can't tell you the number of beggars that I saw, children beggars, adult beggars, the number of people literally living under bridges, washing in rivers, in the city, in the middle of Achung, which is a significant city on the outskirts of Harbin in Heilongjiang province, close to Korea and Russia. And aside from the fact that the climate is brutal up there, I mean, to think about a communist country that has so lost its compass from its original goals, as you know, the positive aspects as well as the negative aspects, I suppose, taking minimal care of their citizens, people living under bridges, washing and bathing and doing laundry in the river under the bridges. I mean, it's unbelievable. And not indexing retirements so that elderly people, essentially, if they didn't have children supporting them or expatriate children supporting them, like my wife was sending money back to China, they would be living under the bridges. They literally would not have the money to live.
Yeah, my son said that he was over there from, I guess, the end of 14 through mid-15. We have relatives over there. He has an uncle and some aunts and that over in China.
Whereabouts do you know?
Qingdao.
Where is that?
That's up on the north part. It's the largest harbor.
Okay.
They call it Qingdao, but it's some of them call it Qingdao.
So it's probably not that far, relatively speaking, from Harbin, from Heilongjiang province.
I don't know. It might not be. I know that it has a population of 60 million people.
Yeah, it's like even the small cities. A small city is 2 million people. That's like Achung.
Yeah. And they have the train runs from Beijing over there. In fact, they have that large harbor there for a freight trade.
I keep hearing, occasionally I watch the Chinese English news, and I think that, is that Guangdong? Something like that?
Guangdong?
Yes.
It's Quingdong, or Dong.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard of that one.
If you go across the water right there, I think it's the Yellow Sea, you're right into the middle of north of Korea.
Okay, so yeah, it's way up in the, actually, it's probably within several hundred miles of Harbin, Achung, in that area. It's probably in or near Heilongjiang province.
But anyway, he was describing, in fact, he put albums of where he took pictures when he was there.
Mm-hmm.
On Facebook, he has three albums that he took. In fact, he said it was funny. One of his cousins pretended he was his guide. They went to Tiananmen Square,
mm-hmm.
and he was shooting pictures of Tiananmen Square, which is technically forbidden.
Really?
Yeah, you can't shoot pictures of Tiananmen Square. They shut off. They used to have, I think, three doors to get into the Forbidden City. in China. Now they only have one way in and one way out.
Now that may be because I know they charge admission, but when I was there, I don't remember for the most part a restriction on taking pictures. There are a couple of little exceptions, but like in Tiananmen Square, one of the most memorable things I did, it was extraordinarily hot. I mean, even our guide came close to passing out. But in the hot sun, there were soldiers or police. It's hard to tell the difference. You know, standing at attention. Some of them were in shade. Many of them were just wearing their military hat. And just their heads were swiveling back and forth, keeping an eye on the square. This was probably about 8 years ago, I guess. And there was this one guy who was standing in full sun at strict attention, surveying the crowd, and I decided to take a picture of him. So I aimed the camera. I was probably about 50 feet from him. I aimed the camera, zoomed in a little bit. He actually stopped surveying the crowd for me. He stood still. And I took the picture and lowered the camera and just raised my hand like a little thank you. And you could see from him the most imperceptible nod of acknowledgement. And then he went back to scanning the crowd. I actually wrote a little piece on my blog about that. What I call flashbulb memory. Great story. And I guess what you're saying is I couldn't do that anymore.
No. They'll come over to you and, like you said, you can't tell the difference between the police and soldiers.
Yeah.
He had two of them come over to where they were, and he started talking Chinese to my son, and he turned to his cousin and said, "What did he say?" He said, "You can't take pictures." My son was taking this with his smartphone.
Oh.
And he said, "Well, why can't, you know," and he said something else. My son turned to him and said, "I don't speak Chinese." And then he asked the police asked his cousin, "You know, what are you doing here?" He says, "I'm his guide."
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a guide, a personal guide in China, they relate that you have money.
Right. Well, you want to know something, I'm going to interrupt you for just 1 second. Even if you are a citizen of the PRC who has lived in the United States for some period of time, whether on a work visa or a green card, you're still a citizen of China. When you come back, like, I am told when I've gone there not to speak. Let them think I'm Russian. And just at this point, when my wife goes back, just the way she's dressed, the accent has changed. Like, my New York accent has changed down here. And they can pick out that she's not a native anymore. She's a foreign Chinese, so they peg her as having money. And I can see how that would happen with the person you're talking about.
Yeah, because his mom's Chinese, so he looks a little, you know, Chinese, but his cousin is, you know, looks just like they do. And then this man was, you know, told him finally, he said, "Okay, I'll let you take one more, then you got to leave."
I'll tell you, I once was at the Harbin Airport, so-called international airport. When I was there, it was in horrible condition. And we went to the baggage area. And to me, seeing what is reputedly an international airport with a totally empty baggage area, I thought that was worthy of a photograph. And a guy came over to me and put his hand in front of my lens and went, no, or the equivalent in Chinese.
Yeah.
Essentially, I guess it was like a national security issue that I couldn't show an empty baggage area.
Yeah.
But when he turned around, I took the picture anyway. I mean, you know, this is what people do. It's very, very hard to manage people. You know, they just snap a shutter and that's it. You've taken the picture. It's done. But yeah, they make the effort. In Achung and Harbin, they had little elevated sort of watchtowers on many corners that used to have police in them all the time, surveilling the population. So the country is very schizophrenic in a lot of different ways. It would take an hour just to really talk about it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, especially the roads.
Yep.
And they took one of the buses because they were going from Qingdao down south to, I guess it would be Gansu, taking pictures of their going, walking, and doing this,
mm-hmm.
and taking buses. And he said the buses are crazy.
Well, yeah, if you're not on a tour bus, I imagine that's true.
Oh, yeah, because he said sometimes the buses don't even stop. They just keep going past you, and he says it's mud roads.
It can be. I guess it depends on how far out into the country you go.
This was just right outside Beijing.
Huh.
It's mud. He said the one thing about China is the food's cheap.
Well,
most of them don't cook at home at all. They go out.
That depends. Yeah, I can tell you that depends.
Yeah.
Do you know what's a special treat to go out to eat? Kentucky Fried Chicken. McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, very big. But going out to like a Western-style fast food restaurant, in terms of the percentage of earnings that it costs, it's the equivalent of going out for a fine dinner here.
Yeah, it is. He said McDonald's was always packed. He told his cousin, he said, "Let's hit McDonald's." He said, "You never get in."
It's a way of showing status, and it's also a way of having a special occasion.
Wow, that's really, I know I talked with him about it, and I was thinking that just to go to McDonald's. And what it really got him was they went to a dinner with his uncle, with some business people that his uncle deals with, and they had all this food put on the table, and when they left, about half of the course hadn't even been touched.
That's Chinese hospitality for you.
If
there's nothing left, the host feels like they did not adequately host the event. It's like if you clean your plate, they put more on because they feel you haven't had enough. So in Chinese culture, it is polite to leave some food on your plate so they feel like they've provided enough. I have to tell you, my wife, when she throws a party, drives me crazy. It's like anything worth doing is worth overdoing. We always have way too much. She's trying to give away food at the end to the guests. But,
it's like if you go to see them, they offer you drink and food before, right there.
You know, when I went to China, about 16 ounces of beer was all I could handle without starting to get a buzz. When I was in China that first time, they just kept refilling the glass over and over and over. And by the time I came back, my alcohol tolerance had increased considerably.
he went through the Chinese National Beer Factory.
Uh-huh.
And he said that was an eye-awakening scene there.
It's a fascinating place. It's nothing like what you expect if you've only heard about it and never been.
No.
It's the value of travel. There's an expression that the past is like a place you can read about but never visit. And you can't understand the past unless you have some way of connecting to it, which is what I like about old movies. But it's true as well of travel. Reading about France or Britain or China, you can't understand a place at all unless you've spent at least a little bit of time there. And don't just see the tourist attractions. Try to get out and see how people are living. That's the education.
Yeah, that's what he was doing. His uncle told him, you guys just go out and see China, take the pictures you want to take.
Or that they let you take.
Yeah, I mean, it was, we were there in 2008 at the Olympics.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy.
Crazy. It doesn't describe it.
I'll just let you go after I got Gary is back and I have to do a break anyway. But one of the things that struck me about China is how poor traffic control is. In America, people would be going absolutely nuts. You'd have accidents at every intersection. It's like traffic laws are just suggestions. And the most popular accessory on a car is the horn.
That's true.
You honk your horn when you're turning. You honk your horn when you're passing. You're always honking your horn. Pedestrians beware. And yet, you never hear screeching tires. You never hear people swearing at each other or making gestures. I don't know how the heck it functions. It's fascinating.
My son says it's like playing bumper cars.
Except they don't bump, which is the amazing part.
Oh, yeah, they do now. They knock each other in these deep ditches. And just keep going.
All right.
On these mud roads, it's terrible.
I appreciate your calling, Bill. We'll have to continue this conversation another time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. My engineer is Bob Gartner, and you can contribute and support KPFT at kpft.org by going to the Trip Jar. So, Bob Since Gary has previously called, but he was on before the person that's currently on, who should we take first? I would think the new caller, wouldn't you? As opposed to the follow-up caller?
You know, you've got these fans that just refuse to leave the stadium.
All right, I'll tell you what.
We'll take Gary.
Okay, let's take Gary, and we'll have to leave a little time for the next. Gary.
All right, well, I'm going to have three things to say, and very quickly.
Okay.
Number one, I wanted to thank you for confirming my point, even if inadvertently, about population, because we're talking about the Chinese economy and its economic power in the world, and you told me about all the people living under bridges.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I rest my case. Number two, I'm from New York, even though I have a very heavy Texas accent.
Oh, yeah, you really do. Not so
and
much.
Number three, I've been a Taoist for 50 years, speaking of China.
Really?
Yes, and that's all I wanted to say. I just thought you'd appreciate that.
You know, another day when we have a little more time early in the show, we can explore that a little bit.
I'll be happy to do that.
All right. Take care, Gary. Thanks for calling back.
Bye-bye.
We still have a little time, and we still have a little open space on the line, 713-526-5738. I do have Jerry, but if someone calls in, I will try to get you on the show and give you at least a minute. 713-526-5738. Jerry, you're next up. Jerry, you're on the air. How you doing?
Yeah, as usual, Gary's factually wrong. He so often is about population issues. If you actually go through and you look at the history and the economic history of the world, basically China and India were the most populous countries for like centuries.
Yeah.
And guess what? They were also the most economically advanced countries for like centuries. That didn't change until into the 1700s.
Well, now, wait a minute. There's a difference between economically advanced and technologically advanced. They had technologies, but they still had rampant poverty. But I will go and maybe take a little bit the side of Gary by making this point. It can be argued, anecdotally, that Europe's great expansion of technology and exploration and domination is an indirect result of the plagues in, what was it, the 13th, 14th centuries?
The Black Death, yeah.
That thinned the population to the point where all of a sudden you didn't have as much pollution. You had more living space. You had per person. You had more agricultural produce per person. Plus, you had a dramatic reduction in the workforce that, much like we were talking about China adding robotics, much like China, Europe had to mechanize in order to make up for the lack of workers because of like a 50% mortality rate, 25 to 50%. So
yeah.
That kind of goes back to the point that a lower population may, in fact, benefit countries that want to expand their power.
Yeah, but that's only in retrospect and everything.
Of course.
The thing about it is, though, is that actually China, like I said, China and India were the economic powerhouses of the world until the 17th century or so, maybe even into the 18th century.
I think you need to define your term in this case, because India is an extremely conquered country. Technologically advanced, highly populated, very civilized, but very conquered. China is not a monolithic entity that has existed in its current form forever. It has shrunk, it has grown, it has been conquered and conquered in return. It has had pieces chopped off and recaptured them. And it has been an economic and military power, but to say it was an economic powerhouse implies that there was more wealth spread around, which really was not the case.
Yeah. Well, I'll just give you one example of what I'm talking about, which is a real historical example. Basically, the Chinese didn't do opium or weren't addicted to opium. They didn't have any issues with opium. It was banned from the kingdom because, for obvious reasons. But the only thing that the Brits had to trade, in fact, was opium.
And they fought a war for the right
to
export it to China.
Now, what does that say? That tells me that, basically Britain didn't have anything. and all that. You know, if Britain was doing that great economically, it seems to me like they would have had a lot of other better stuff to sell off to the Chinese to keep the trade balance even.
Well, the Chinese, I think they just really didn't want anything the British had.
No, I don't think so either.
And that had to do a lot with the mentality of the Chinese being the center of the world.
Well, no doubt that's true, but the thing about it is if you go over to Asia, though, and I haven't been over there like you have, but, you know, from what I've heard from different people is all those countries think, you know, Vietnam and Korea and all those countries, those people, you know, their cultures go back 3,000-4,000 years,
yeah,
and they think they're it.
Yeah. Well, even the Europeans have been known to look down on Americans as the newcomers.
Well, yeah,
you know,
but
all,
I'm just saying,
the
though, you know, they
from
really
their
do
countries
have,
went to the United
know,
States.
They can actually sit there and point out and show you that they have, like, you know, a cultural continuity going back, like, you know, like 4,000 years in some cases, maybe a little bit more.
Even five.
And anyway, that's it. But also, I also wanted to say that, well, no, I'll go ahead and let you go.
Well, 30 seconds. Give you 30 seconds.
I was going to say Churchill's the case of a highly intelligent, highly creative leader who kept on having problems. Churchill would achieve high office, not the prime, you know, didn't become the prime minister, but he kept on achieving high office, but then he kept on having problems. He either made a mistake or people didn't understand what he was about or whatever.
He didn't suffer fools gladly.
No, and he didn't suffer fools gladly. That's true. And, you know, he was the man for the time there in World War II, but, you know, basically there were several times Churchill thought his political career was over.
Yeah, and then eventually he was right. Okay, I'm going to let you go, Jerry. It's time for me to start to wrap up.
Okay, that's fine.
Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Take care. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Do remember to support your community station, KPFT. We have something like 200 independent programs every week, and that requires money to do, even though so much of it is volunteer. So go to kpft.org, hit the tip jar. Maybe mention Think Wing Radio is the reason you're calling. And don't worry about the busy signals. And I guess I'll sign off with this quote.
On the tape.
On the tape. All right, here's my quote of the night to sign off. If you don't want to hear it on the radio, don't do it. That's from Maxine Messenger, gossip columnist of The Chronicle, who passed away in 2001. She did some great stuff. If you don't want to hear it on the radio, don't do it. Have a great week. I'll speak to you next Monday. And Jazz Latino.
With Juan Flores.
Mark your calendars. Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, is coming to Houston. The award-winning journalist and author is touring the country in celebration of Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. You are cordially invited to a rare and special event. Amy Goodman speaks in Houston on Sunday, May 1st, May Day. Time and location are to be announced soon. Come see the host of Democracy Now! On Sunday, May 1st, in an event for KPFT Houston.
Nada, sai da minha frente que eu quero passar. Pois o samba está animado. O que eu quero é samba. Este samba que é misto de maracatu.
There has never been a better time to donate your car to KPFT. When you contact the KPFT car donation hotline, you will do something great for this community. Call 1-855-573-8227 to donate or find out more information. KPFT is the only radio station of its kind located in Texas. It broadcasts music, news, information, and cultural programming.